On this week's 51%, we head to the U.S.-Mexico border and find out how women are gaining self-esteem.
I am worth something as a woman, and I have done a lot, and I had not realized this.
Plus, transgender people are grappling with a new policy from the Trump administration, and hear from some teens who worked on an album for Somali youth. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
So much trouble in the home of the brave and the land of the free. Ooh. Am I an immigrant or am I a new slave made for all brutality? I don't think so.
With focus on the U.S.-Mexico border having intensified in recent history, there is much disturbing news. Family separations, anti-vigilante groups harassing migrants in New Mexico, and much more. But some are fighting back. They are on the front lines of hate, and their weapons are solidarity and hard work. They are young and old and from a range of professions and backgrounds. The camaraderie is visible at a soup kitchen run by the Kino Border Initiative in Nogales, Mexico. This workforce faces the border crises head-on, elbow to elbow and heart to heart, with dedication and resistance. Dr. Diana Bryson Barnes, a senior teaching professor in World Languages and Literatures and International Affairs at Skidmore College in New York, brings us a border story from the perspective of a few women.
Ask anybody taking a meal and a rest at the Kino Border Initiative soup kitchen in Nogales, Mexico about crises. From this point on the map, the migrants just on the other side of our southern border are not the cause of the crisis. Their presence here in this Mexican border town represents a lifetime of crises, only a part of which rises from the earth in steel beams that separate them from where they want to be. This is a town where Americans cross daily into Mexico to get dental work done cheaply, or to go to lunch at La Roca, a Mexican restaurant with mariachis and guacamole and tortilla soup. It is a town where Mexicans cross daily into the United States to shop and then return home to Mexico at the end of the day. Both cities in the U.S. and in Mexico are named Nogales, one city with a wall that runs through it. To cross from the U.S. into Mexico, you just walk right in, no ID necessary. To cross into the U.S., there is a process, passing through customs and border protection. Everyone needs a passport or a visa to get in. This is also a port of entry where tens of thousands of individuals annually are deported or repatriated. Last year, 25,378 people were deported to Nogales, Mexico, from all over the United States. The first place anyone goes when they are deported to this Mexican town is a soup kitchen that everyone knows about in Nogales. It is run by a binational Catholic organization called the Kino Border Initiative, and it welcomes migrants, either those who have been deported or those who have just arrived from the South looking to cross into the United States through asylum from Central America or illegally through the desert. Last year, the Kino Border Initiative served more than 40,600 meals to migrants. What is striking about this little humble building and the organization behind it is not only the number of migrants who pass through its doors and eat at its tables, but also the volunteers and their dedicated and enduring solidarity that keep it going. All along this 2,000-mile line from California to Texas, people come to help at the border, to pick up the pieces of broken immigration policies that leave people homeless and desperate. Thousands of volunteers all along this line come together at this place of division to help, to do something in the face of what seems to be overwhelming obstacles for those experiencing deportation, abject poverty, family separation. For the volunteers that I meet here, politics may have prompted their decision to come to the border, but they don't enter into the conversation at the border where these volunteers donate their time and their expertise. I met three women whose lives, otherwise very different from each other's, intersect here in Nogales.
Mi nombre es Alicia Guevara Pérez, religiosa misionera de la Eucaristía.
My name is Alicia Guevara Pérez. I am with the religious order Missionaries of the Eucharist. I have been a sister for 40 years and I have been living here in Nogales, working with the Kino Border Initiative for 5 years.
Hermana Alicia is content with her work on the border, and in particular, in her job as coordinator for Casa Nazaret, or Nazareth House, a shelter for women and children, also run by Kino. Last year, 360 women and children took refuge at Casa Nazaret. One of those women is Cynthia, who found the comedor after she was deported to Nogales, Cynthia Martinez López.
I came to the Kino Border Initiative, and well, right now, more than anything, I feel grateful and a deep friendship with them because they have helped me so much. When I got here, I didn't know anybody or anything.
Cynthia, who is 33 years old, found a safe place to stay, a change of clothing, a pillow, a blanket, food at the Kino Border Initiative shelter. Cynthia was able to survive with their help, and find work in Nogales to begin to rebuild her life and to chip away at the more than $3,000 charged by the coyotes to take her across the desert into the U.S. This will take years. Cynthia said she earned $73 a week, working 12-hour days, 5 days a week for a medical device company from the U.S. based in Mexico. This kind of pay is common in the maquiladoras, U.S.-owned factories in border cities. Cynthia was alone and desperate when she found Casa Nazaret and Sister Alicia. She is not unlike hundreds of other women who spend time in the shelter, many with families still in the United States. Most of the women in the shelter have lived in the United States for 10 years or more and had returned to Mexico because of a death in the family or because a relative was dying without knowing how difficult it would be to return to the United States.
When they return and try to cross over, sometimes they try 3-4 times and they can't cross. And for them, it's very painful to be in communication with their children. And, Mama, I want you to be here with me. And the children cry, and the moms cry, and the children are on the side of the border, and the moms are on the side of the border, and there is no border that can be crossed. So it's very difficult for them to go back to their place of origin because they don't have family there anymore. Their family, husband, children, even brothers and sisters are in the U.S. So their suffering is very great. And it's hard for me, but at the same time, I want to be strong for them. Because for me, they are so brave, because they risk their lives in the desert to be with their children. Most of the women who I have known in the shelter have children who are U.S. citizens, because they went to the U.S. when they were very young and met their husbands there and had a family there.
Cynthia helps out at Casa Nazaret and at the soup kitchen when they need an extra hand. Casa Nazaret opened 11 years ago, and since then, thousands of women and children have found shelter there. Since Sister Alicia has been in Nogales working with Kino, she has seen a lot of suffering. She has also seen a lot of healing, a lot of self-empowerment.
One of the things that they love, and that I love as well, is to share with them about self-esteem. I believe that they, as women in their homes, have not felt valued, not by their husbands, by their families. Sometimes by themselves, they have not recognized how valuable they are as women. When we talk about this, how empowered they are with all the strengths that they have as mothers, they are like, well, yes, I am worth something as a woman. And I have done a lot, and I had not realized this.
Right now, there are a lot of children at the shelter, so many that Sister Alicia has enlisted the help of the shelter residents to coordinate a multi-aged classroom of sorts.
Luego con los más chiquitos pintamos.
So the youngest children paint, and the moms paint too. They paint mandalas. We paint mandalas together.
Coloring pictures of mandalas, spiritual circles, is one way to alleviate stress for the women in the shelter. Another is laughter. This is one of the things that Sister Alicia appreciates so much about Shura Wallen, who for almost 2 decades has spent every Tuesday in Nogales, Mexico at the Comedor. Wallen is a retiree from Berkeley, California, who lives with her husband in Green Valley, Arizona. Sister Alicia has a deep appreciation for Wallen's ability to make the migrants laugh.
Pero Shura es una mujer excepcional.
She's an exceptional woman. She says her objective coming to the Comedor every Tuesday is to brighten their day, to make them laugh. She is a mature woman, an older woman, but she has a young heart.
Wallen comes to the Comedor with a group of Green Valley and Tucson Samaritans. She is among others who regularly donate their time here. The Tucson Samaritans, founded in 2002, are dedicated to humanitarian aid to migrants. Their mission statement describes their members as, quote, people of faith and conscience who are responding directly, practically, and passionately to the crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. Wallen's daily life is dedicated to this. When she is not at the Comedor, you may find her with other Samaritans in the desert, searching for human remains on the migrant trails, or placing crosses where the human remains were found, or leaving water and provisions on the trails. Temperatures in the desert can reach 130 degrees in the summer and can drop to freezing in the winters. Migrants unaware of the environment venture unprepared into the Sonoran Desert. At one point, Shura walked the distance between the Mexico border and Tucson to experience what the migrants themselves experience. But at the Comedor, she mixes laughter with stark reality.
If I have the time, if I'm not busy in the Comedor before they come in, I'll go out and you know, give them a hug or something. But I always speak to them, tell them when they're in the Comedor, and tell them what we do, that we're from Green Valley and that we are on the desert and so on and so forth. And then when I finish, I will say to them, no entiendo ni papas, which means I don't even know potatoes. That's exactly what they do. They're sitting there and they're listening, and all of a sudden you see these smiles on their faces. And I tell them also that I like to dance on the table. And they're like, they start laughing. And to me, that is such a gift to them.
Shura won't lie to the migrants who intend to cross illegally into the U.S. through the desert. It takes at least 7 days to walk from the border to Tucson across rugged, inhospitable terrain. More than 7,000 remains have been recovered in the Sonoran Desert in the past 20 years, according to U.S. Border Patrol figures. And there are countless others who have died in the desert whose remains are never found. So real numbers to count the dead are elusive.
I think it is enormously important to be as forthright with them as you possibly can. And sometimes I will say, you really cannot go. You cannot go. You are not going to make this journey. You're not going to get to the end of this journey by going across the desert. Your end will be on the desert. And I don't want to come out there and find your body.
Wallen admits it is difficult for many people to understand what prompts illegal immigration.
You'll hear, well, I would never. And I say, you would never, huh? What would you do if somebody came to you with a gun to your head? Tell me what you would do if you were watching your children starve to death. Tell me what you would do if you knew, if you let your child go out to play, the chances of your seeing your child again were pretty close to zero. Tell me what you would do. Well, no, answer that question. You would do exactly what these people are having to do. Do they want to do it? Do they want to leave their country and their friends and their families? No, they don't.
Cynthia knows all about this sentiment. She knows that desperation charges the decision that tens of thousands of migrants make to search for a better life in the United States. And she would like people to know why migrants are forced to make the difficult decision to leave their homes and their families behind.
Si ellos pudieran ir, por ejemplo, no a donde de donde venimos.
Because if they could go, for example, to where we came from, at least for me, if I could show them, reveal to them how my mother lives, what my little village is like. In other words, if they could experience for themselves what is there and saw one of the motivations for leaving to come here. This is my own experience. And there are people who have experienced far worse. I've always said that there are people worse off than I, trying to cross the desert, cross the United States, people who have lost parts of their bodies in the train. I know some girls from the shelter that slept alone in the desert, who heard the coyotes howling.
Sister Alicia says that when she first started working in the shelter, it was hard to keep so many sad stories in her heart. But she has gained strength from the women she has met in the shelter and those who have come to help them.
I will say that they feel very content every day. It's like I feel happy more than anything with the woman where I am. Because I have learned so much from them, really. They impress me so very much. Where does she get such courage, this woman? I say to myself. Where? Where? I listen to her problems. I see her tears, her pain. But then it's as though this strength, this power of joy and hope arises in her, even though everything is so very difficult for her. Always hopeful, waiting for something with her confidence in God. For me, this affects me deeply.
Sister Alicia is 56 years old and Cheryl Wallen, 77. They speak different languages, come from different generations, different countries. But what they do have in common is a bond that stretches all along this border where thousands of people are joining together from all over this country to lend a hand, to help migrants like Cynthia or Central American families seeking asylum in El Paso, Texas. There is an enduring force that is present in U.S.-Mexico border cities, a force of volunteers working long hours to lend a hand because they believe that it is the right thing to do. There is a positive force all along the border that does not make headlines, and it does not come in the form of concertina wire hanging round after round on the border wall or in the form of vigilant Border Patrol officers policing the line. This is a force born of a bond of solidarity by those who share the simple belief that people should help each other.
That was Dr. Diana Bryson Barnes bringing us the story with music by Manhattan Composers Collective, which also produced the piece. The Pentagon has just implemented a Trump administration policy that greatly restricts transgender people from joining or serving in the military. The policy took effect April 12th, though it still faces several legal challenges. Some service branches are trying to lessen the impact on transgender troops, as Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project.
Under the new rule, trans troops who are already in the military can continue to serve, but they can't transition to another sex unless they were diagnosed with gender dysphoria before the policy took effect, April 12th. Troops who can't comply can be discharged. As a result, advocates say trans service members and would-be recruits scrambled to meet the deadline.
There's definitely been a rush to get doctor's appointments and expedite the process of obtaining that diagnosis.
Jamie Hash is an Air Force tech sergeant who transitioned to being a woman several years ago. She speaks on behalf of trans people who serve and has counseled Air Force leaders about how best to support their trans colleagues. Hash argues that the policy has forced people to decide in a hurry whether to come out as trans and seek a diagnosis.
I think for some people, they may not have been in a situation where they were ready to start the process, but this new policy has kind of put them in a situation where they either have to obtain now or they will no longer be able to in the future.
But getting a diagnosis proved challenging for many, especially for those who were deployed. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Bree Fram is a member of SPARTA, a transgender military advocacy group.
If I had to say top two issues that the service members have faced, it's getting an appointment and seeing a doctor willing to diagnose them given the criteria that are required. Luckily, we've had a number of military medical providers go out of their way to add additional appointments or consider telemedicine for some folks that are deployed or are just having trouble getting an appointment.
Fram says many trans people who are serving don't yet have a gender dysphoria diagnosis for reasons like career uncertainty or social stigma.
Honestly, we're worried that they're going to leave the service, and they have a lot to offer, but if they need to take care of themselves, they may need to leave the service in order to do that.
Current service members aren't the only ones who were crunched by the deadline. Fram says openly transgender people trying to enlist met with a barrage of misinformation at recruiting offices, even before April 12th, when it was still okay for them to join.
So it varies wildly because recruiter by recruiter, they have different information and different information sources. So some people will talk to a recruiter and the recruiter will say, no, that the policy is we don't take trans people. And they might be basing that on a tweet or something they heard otherwise, but not the actual policy.
Some service branches have taken steps to mitigate the policy's impact, according to advocates. Sparta says the Air Force made it easier for airmen to submit and get provisional approval for gender dysphoria diagnoses made by civilian doctors. Meanwhile, the Navy has announced that trans service members can dress as their preferred gender while off duty. Throughout the military, some troops were given leeway if they had trouble getting a gender dysphoria diagnosis from a military doctor in time. Shannon Minter is the legal director for the National Center for Lesbian Rights and a lawyer challenging the policy. He says the services don't like the Defense Department's new rule.
They don't want to ban transgender people. They recognize these are valuable colleagues. We've seen like this constant pattern of resistance of the military trying to soften the blow and protect transgender service members as much as they can, and then being constantly overridden by political leaders from the top.
A spokesman for the Air Force didn't go that far, but said, "We are in the business of taking care of airmen and commanders at all levels and will continue to do so." This is Carson Frame reporting.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Somali-American kids and a London musician are making music together. Minneapolis teens recently teamed up with Armanta to produce the first album for Somali youth in decades. Titled Children Have the Priority, the album includes classic educational songs and spoken word poems. KFAI's Emily Bright reports.
At the Cedar Cultural Center in Cedar Riverside, Minneapolis, I'm Emily Bright. Children remember the songs their parents sing. For Kadro Mumin, it was a Somali lullaby.
My mom used to say, like, hua-ya, hua-ya, ho-ya, that we joke. That, like, hua-hua is like, go to sleep, your mother is here, she's in the kitchen, she's cooking food. That's how my mom sang it, but then every parent does it a little different, which is like putting your own twist on, like, Rockabye Baby.
That version of Hua Hua appears on a new Somali kids album featuring Minneapolis teens. In this twist, the song paints an image of peace among Somalis across the diaspora. The new album is called Children Have the Priority. That's the English language title. In Somali, that's
Ubat Kamalantale, and it's sort of like giving these students, like, we have the rights and we have the priority and we're the ones who come first because we're the next generations.
Mumin helped coordinate those youth for the grant-funded project, about 30 teens in all, mostly from the Cedar Riverside. The album is a mix of Somali and English, of the teen spoken words and the smooth vocals of international Somali pop star Armanta. Armanta called the record a great opportunity.
It's not just a challenge, it will be historic because nothing like this was done for at least decades.
Decades. Not since the Somali Civil War broke out in the early 1990s. Not since before the teens who worked with Manta on the album were born. Some of the teens were a bit starstruck.
They're like, you're doing this? Wait, I know this artist. I've seen him. He's in the UK, right? Wow.
That's 15-year-old Rama Farah, who worked on the album. Farah is tall, with black-rimmed glasses, braces, and a black hijab.
We usually don't do this type of thing in this, like, community, where you usually just about school, get good grades, and then come home.
Farah says she listens to a mix of Somali and pop music, but she's always had a hard time understanding the Somali lyrics, which follow strict poetic forms. As for writing music?
Music is a whole different thing. Like, they just think it's like, you're not supposed to be doing that. Like, some Muslim families are just like, music, that's something you shouldn't be doing. But my family's really supportive. They're like, I love this. This is such a beautiful song.
Youth coordinator Kadro Mumin says Farah started out the year super shy and has completely blossomed, to the point where she reads from her poem Islam on the album.
The hijab is a symbol of beauty and modesty. Covering my head feels amazing in all honesty. They say, don't you get hot in the summer weather? Honestly, I couldn't feel any better. See, the hijab is like...
I asked Farah about writing this poem.
I just thought about all the stuff that was going on right now, and like all that Islamophobia and all that sorts of things that are going on. And it was just like, people need to hear this. Like, people need to understand we're just normal people just like you. You don't got to be afraid of us.
When Farah sees the performance space for the album release concert, her jaw drops.
I was like, there's so much chairs. And the lady was telling me 200 people might show up. That's insane.
But when the big night comes, she sounds confident. And that's the goal, even more than making an historic album. Encouraging Somali-American teens through the power of creativity, as Armanta puts it.
I think there's a lot of, when young people are dealing with issues, quite serious issues, then if they have that means of channeling their energy and their ideas, it can only be a positive thing.
Overall, the result is incredibly positive. Welcome to our neighborhood, the children sing. This is where we're from. This is what we hope and dream. We will share this with the world. For KFAI, I'm Emily Bright.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1554.